Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. So what's up, y'all? I know personally I've been feeling really lost this week. I've been sad and angry and confused as to why oppression rules this society. But what keeps me going is reminding myself that history and time are cyclical. Although it's so hard to notice right now, there's a light somewhere at the end of this tunnel. Keep reading, keep talking, keep voting, keep protesting, because we can make this world a better place. I know that sounds a little preachy, but hope is revolutionary. That being said, take care of your mental health this week. And well, you should always. I know personally, I can't pour from an empty cup. So do what you need to keep yourself present. Go for a walk, with a mask on, of course. Call your grandma, bake some cookies. You know what you need to do. Switching gears, we've got another amazing show in store for you all today. We'll start with this week's top headlines, transition into our deep dive, and we'll cap off the show with returning guest, Delilah Ago-Utahilly. Oh, and just a heads up, we were forced to record away from our Sit Still studio this week, so the sound quality might not be as clear and professional as we tend to strive for. Yeah, that's what happens when Claire is in charge and Mike is away. We appreciate your patience. Part of my self-care is drinking a well-deserved margarita. Go grab yourself whatever drink you damn well please, and let's get started. Up first, this week's headlines. This week, John McCain's widow, Cindy McCain, endorsed Joe Biden. With this proclamation, the curse of hatred and denial was lifted, and all the people in the land were restored to goodness and peace, and we all lived happily ever after. Hey, a girl can dream, right? At a rally over the weekend, Trump told his supporters that the difference between Democrats and Republicans was having good genes. It must be all that extra room in the crotch. It is still funny he would consider himself to be a product of good genetics. Trump looks like someone who comes from a family that wanted to keep the bloodline pure. The statement followed another controversial Trump move when he announced his plan to make schools teach American exceptionalism. Proposed classes include AP Racial Bias and Gaslighting 101. Intro to Human Decency is permanently canceled. But really, good genes? American exceptionalism? At this point, he's not even trying to hide being a Nazi. He's like the software version of Hitler where they tried to upgrade it, but somehow the system got shittier. Like, at least Hitler liked dogs. Republicans vowed to replace the Supreme Court seat just hours after Justice Ginsburg's death, blatantly contradicting their stance of not filling Supreme Court seats in an election year. At this point, for Republicans, Pinocchio is less of a cautionary tale and more of an aspirational one. Mitt Romney chimed in by announcing he won't block a vote on Trump's Supreme Court nominees, because he'll do whatever it takes to eat lunch with the popular kids. New Jersey successfully passed a new tax on incomes over $1 million, so be prepared for lots of outrage from people who don't have $1 million. Trump again promised that his secret healthcare plan would be ready, quote, soon. Right, because nothing instills confidence in the American people like using the language that Comcast uses on its customer service line. On Tuesday, Trump expanded his ban on racial sensitivity training to all federal employees, saying that Americans should be taught to take pride in our great country, and if you don't, there is nothing in it for you. Okay, well, just this week alone, reports emerged that a private ICE detention center in Georgia performed hysterectomies on unaware detainees. On Wednesday, the grand jury in Louisville, Kentucky, indicted Brett Hankinson with three charges of wanton endangerment in the first degree, Meanwhile, Jonathan Mattingly and Miles Cosgrove were not charged for the murder of Breonna Taylor. And finally, to put a cherry on this whole shit Sunday that was this week, on Wednesday, Trump refused to commit to the peaceful transition of power if he were to lose the presidency. It baffles me how people continue to support such an unapologetic fascist. It's the equivalent of asking someone to piss in their own coffee just so they could own the libs. To me, our headline section this week feels less like us telling jokes and more like obituaries. Please vote. This week's episode is brought to us by Theater in the Dark's A War of the Worlds, a virtual audio drama.
No one would have believed.
You see this? What's happening in the suburbs?
In the first years of the 21st century.
Wi-Fi's not working.
That this world was being watched keenly and closely.
What's happening?
By intelligences greater than our own.
I've seen Kankakee. We should drive out and see it.
Careful. Don't get too close.
Dr. Pearson, have there been fresh attempts to signal these beings?
This October.
It's something more than a meteorite.
Theater in the Dark presents.
It's a cylinder.
And it's opening.
A War of the Worlds. A virtual audio drama performed live every night over Zoom. Pay what you can, tickets available now at theaterinthedark.com.
And now, this week's deep dive. So before we begin today's episode, I wanted to let you all know that we will be changing the type of content we put out based on our listeners' preference. That means you, the listener, will get to choose what episode we write about next. We were going to have a website where you could go, but we figured that could be too easily hacked. We came to this conclusion by watching the pilot episode of Mr. Robot. Nonetheless, we have decided that it will be much easier for you, the listener, to be able to vote for what episode you want to hear if you mail it to us in letter form. Only Season 1 fans will be eligible to vote on upcoming episodes. If you have listened to Season 1, please submit proof that you have listened to all 18 episodes. Any proof submitted that is not notarized by an official notary will not be considered and immediately discarded. When mailing in your vote, please only mail in using 9x11 catalog envelopes. We will not accept standard commercial envelopes. Any votes sent in using commercial envelopes will not be considered and immediately discarded. And finally, all votes must be sent in one day after this episode airs. Any votes sent in after 24 hours will not be considered and immediately discarded. Other than that, we are so excited to hear the voice of you, the listener. Sound complicated yet? Welcome to our episode on voter suppression. This episode is so topical, to say the least. I mean, it's why we picked it. When Mike and I were writing the Vote by Mail episode, Mike mentioned that to completely understand the VBM system, we need to address voter suppression. And let me tell you, that was one of those moments when all I could say was, duh, of course that's a Season 2 episode. And here we are. So what exactly even is voter suppression? Well, voter suppression is any maneuver made by either a group or an individual that is crafted to manipulate the outcome of a vote by preventing those who may vote in opposition to a policy, candidate, or party. The course of action can range from the spread of disinformation, legal restrictions, and even so far as intimidating opposing voters. You know, all the things that never happen in America. Eye roll. But why does voter suppression even exist in the first place? To understand this, you guessed it, we've got to travel back in time. I know you all love the history section just as much as I do. And now more than ever, history seems to be repeating itself. And the only way to learn from that is to look back on the pitfalls of our collective past lives. We study history for a reason, people. I know I may be screaming into a void on this, but hey, you are listening to this podcast after all. Anyway,
In researching this episode, I was surprised to learn that voter suppression has existed as long as voting has existed. We're talking like ancient Greece and Rome, which was another duh moment. Like, I don't know why I thought that things were easy breezy back in ancient times. Honestly, it's probably because history is told by the victors. And for the powerful, everything really was fine and dandy. Except for maybe Caesar. He was the originator of getting backstabbed. Woof. Anyway, although the Greeks and Romans introduced the world to voting, they also in turn created voter suppression. It's a double-edged sword, kind of like the one Caesar was stabbed with. Remember, not all people were equal in those ancient societies. There was still a social hierarchy in which the wealthy and powerful enslaved people. Betcha forgot that tidbit because, well, I did too. In Athens, or sometimes called the birthplace of democracy, you had to be a citizen to vote. And that citizenship badge was only awarded to men who completed their military training and their sons.
So, no women, slaves, or alien residents were allowed to partake in the democratic process. And just to clarify, we're talking about ancient Greece, not 17th century America. Although you gotta admit they sound pretty similar, because, like I said earlier,
history repeats itself. Learn from it, damn it! Ancient Rome also had their fair share of voter suppression. At the birth of the Roman Empire, only the wealthy families or patricians were citizens, and only they held voting rights. But after a general strike, the working class, aka plebeians, aka weak-ass plebs, were granted citizenship and voting privileges if they completed military service, owned land, or if their parents checked either of those two boxes. Women could be granted citizenship, but without voting rights, and enslaved people could buy their freedom and earn status as a voting citizen. Obviously, there were large hoops to jump through, and restrictions on citizenship made participating in the democratic process extremely difficult. Okay, so cool, Claire, thanks for this dusty history lesson, but what does that have to do with modern voting suppression? Well, if you remember back to season one, in our early episodes, we discussed how the Founding Fathers heavily relied on Greek and Roman governing practices when creating the United States. And yep, that includes voting too. First and foremost, you gotta be a citizen to vote. But the Constitution written in 1787 does not delineate the requirements for being a citizen. It only simply alludes to it. Ooh, how mysterious. Anyway, this means that it was up to the states to decide who was a citizen and thus who could vote. This also leads to why today there are so many confusing restrictions from state to state. So, simple, right? You gotta be a citizen to vote. But as the United States expanded, the question of citizenship became more confusing than ever. A few of the key markers, though, were being a dude and owning land. The Naturalization Act of 1790 put it this way. Any alien, being a free white person who had lived in the U.S. for more than 2 years, was deemed a citizen. Oh, and by white person, they mean white man. By 1850, all property restrictions as well as religious tests were removed. But there was still no suffrage for women, Black, Asian, or Indigenous Americans. A lot of this changed with the passage of the 14th Amendment in 1868. I say changed lightly because, well, it's been 152 years since then, and we're still doing an episode on modern voter suppression. Regardless, the 14th Amendment states that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. Basically, if you're born here, you're a citizen. This was a huge turning point, and the 14th Amendment has been invaluable in loads of Supreme Court cases. And we can't address the 14th Amendment without mentioning its counterpart, the 15th Amendment, which reads, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." Sounds straightforward, right? Ideally, yes. But this is where the loopholes start forming. After the passage of the 15th Amendment, various states began passing laws and promoting the use of poll taxes, literacy tests, and grandfather clauses. And the Jim Crow era saw immense voter intimidation. These OG voter suppression tactics led to generations of Americans who were denied their right to vote. To provide insight to this mindset, here are a couple of questions from literacy tests in the Jim Crow era that were specifically given to anyone who wasn't white. 1. Draw a line around the number or letter of this sentence. 2. Draw a line under the last word of this line. 3. Cross out the longest word in this line. 4. Circle the first letter of the alphabet in this line. 5. Above the letter X, make a small cross. These are just a few examples of the ridiculous questions that were asked. And if you thought, well, maybe with some time I could figure these out, You couldn't, because the time limit to complete these tests was 10 minutes. In terms of women's right to vote, we know that women all gained suffrage in 1920 with the 19th Amendment. Well, kinda. That is, white women gained suffrage in 1920. It wasn't until the 1960s, through the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that all women, regardless of race, were granted full accessibility to voting. The 1960s also gave way to the 24th Amendment, which prohibited the use of poll taxes. The Voting Rights Act also gave the federal government enforcement powers to ensure states did not infringe on any voting rights. And that's the history of voter suppression, and now everything is great and totally normal! Psych. The thing is, while when we talk about the history of voter suppression, it feels like that's all in the past. It's all behind us now. There's no more inequality or racism. All lives matter, right? At least that's what I keep seeing on Facebook. But the sad truth is that techniques of voter suppression are implemented with ways that are just as out in the open as back during the Jim Crow era. Things we already mentioned, like limiting access to polls, voter intimidation, voter caging, and disinformation. You may be asking yourself, wait, we've had equal voting rights since the 1960s. How could those techniques even be allowed to be implemented? Well, based on my reading, it all hinges on one thing: the repeal of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. See, in 2013, the Supreme Court struck down the enforcement provisions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. These are the provisions that required states to have any voting restrictions verified for the U.S. government for any racial biases, usually creating protection from things like poll taxes for minorities or literacy tests like the questions we read earlier. Basically, if states wanted to add measures of security, it had to be approved by the government first to make sure it wasn't racist or discriminatory. Chief Justice Roberts explained his decision by saying, "Nearly 50 years later, things have changed dramatically, largely because of the Voting Rights Act. Voter turnout and registration rates in covered jurisdictions now approach parity. Blatantly discriminatory evasions of federal decrees are rare, and minority candidates hold office at unprecedented levels. I.e., we have a black president, so we don't need this law anymore." Right, because without enforcement or consequences, humans have proven to be really moral. I mean, come on. Even with enforcements and consequences, humans have proven to be incredibly stupid, selfish, and unabashedly racist. Look at Americans' reactions to being told to wear masks during the coronavirus. The point that can best be demonstrated by looking at the tactics immediately implemented by the 9 states following this decision. The 9 states in question were Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and my home state of Virginia. I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but there is a clear connection here between all these states. I don't even have to say it because you already know. They're all SEC teams. Almost immediately, each of these states introduced security measures by limiting access to polls. A study conducted by the Leadership of Civil and Human Rights found that since the Supreme Court ruling, over 1,200 polling places have been closed in the states listed above, specifically in areas populated heavily by people of color. As of 2020, there are 7 counties in Georgia that were only provided with 1 polling center. For contrast, I can walk to 3 from my apartment in my gentrified neighborhood of Chicago. To quote an article written by Reuters, the report comes as Republican-led states impose a range of other restrictions, from shorter voting hours to photo ID requirements. As turnout has surged in recent elections, voters in cities like Phoenix, Arizona, and Atlanta, Georgia, have endured hours-long waits to cast their ballots. Because of this, researchers found that voters in Black neighborhoods waited 29% longer to vote. Could you imagine if this happened in white neighborhoods? Karens flip their shit when they have to wait more than 5 minutes for their mocha-spiced caramel frappuccino. If this happened in white polling places, they would have to have a specific queue just for them labeled "Request to talk to the manager." Although, it's not just racially biased. I mean, it's mostly racially biased, but newer techniques are now being implemented to target other demographics as well. As we've said in previous podcasts, the younger generation of voters tend to be much more liberal. Because of this, efforts to block voting at college campuses in Florida revealed a stark pattern of discrimination towards college students, who tend to skew more liberal. Which, if you think about it, is every college. Not only is access to polling sites restricted by locations, but access can be restricted by the number of early voting days or the hours at which voting locations are open, often with the same effect of longer lines during early voting as on election day. Early voting allows for workers without the luxury of time off or a flexible schedule the opportunity to vote. Going back to the racial profiling thing, Studies have shown that Black voters are twice as likely to use early voting as white voters, and that 70% of Black voters voted early in 2008 and in 2012. These two specific statistics were based on Ohio and North Carolina, but you get the point. Just to reiterate, as soon as the enforcement section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act was struck down, states limited access to polling places by shutting them down and cutting their hours, thus extending their wait times. We will refer to this as the Comcast method. The next tactic we're going to talk about eliminates certain people's right to voting altogether, specifically the voting rights of felons.
Which seems a tad hypocritical to me because, well, Trump continues to vote in every election. We'd list out all of the indictments in his administration, but then it would turn into a whole other episode.
Nonetheless, if we turn our eyes to Florida, we're presented with a perfect example. In 2018, the state legislature passed an amendment in the state constitution to return voting rights to felons who completed their sentences. The GOP-controlled legislature quickly wrote provisions for the amendment, declaring all fines, restitutions, and fees associated with their imprisonment must be paid back before voting. The state has no centralized listing for these fines and estimates that it would take several years before such a system is built and felons would be able to identify how much they owe. Imagine getting out of prison and having to pay a bill for your stay. Like, they didn't voluntarily check into a Marriott for 2 to 6 years. They were placed there. Then imagine that you accept this continued injustice, and when you ask for the bill, they give you a piece of paper that just says, Google it. As of July 2020, the Supreme Court has declined to review the stay placed on the lawsuit, giving Floridian felons no recourse to regain their voting rights. By doing this, 1.4 million people successfully have had their votes forcibly suppressed, even though by our country's legal standards, they have served their sentence for crimes committed. We'll call this one the Marriott method. Another not-so-subtle tactic of voter suppression that is being employed is voter purging. When one day throughout the year, all crimes in America are legal, including murder. Oh, wait, sorry. That's just the tagline for the movie The Purge. My bad, guys. Voter purging refers to the practice of removing voters from active voter registration based on criteria that leads the state to believe the person's address or other status is no longer valid. This definitely seems like a more accurate definition. Although looking at the direction our country is heading, the movie The Purge is looking more and more like a historical drama each day. The practice of voter purging is often seen as racially motivated, and while it's been struck down in some state court systems, many others practice it routinely. In fact, the function of voter registration is a direct descendant from Jim Crow laws themselves, designed to keep undesired voters from being able to vote. The best way to combat this is to constantly check your registration status online before an election. You know, how every American wishes to spend their Saturdays. I don't really know what else to say about this one. It's pretty self-explanatory. We'll just call it the Bloom House method.
The last form of voter suppression I wish to talk about is disinformation, a topic so relevant, we had a whole podcast episode dedicated to it last season. It's the whole scheme that Russia implemented in our last election and are attempting to do again. As a reminder, though, disinformation is the spreading of intentionally false information. Campaigns preying on the lack of civic education often seek to inform voters that Election Day is held on an incorrect date, that elections now accept vote by text, or that voting days are separate for different party affiliations. Perhaps the most current example of disinformation being spread is that voting by mail is a direct path to voter fraud. Another topic that we dedicated a whole episode to. Feel free to go back and re-listen if you need a refresher. Once again, the best way to check if suspected information may not be correct is to verify the date and author and then seek another source from a trusted publisher. In the meantime, we can call this one the disinformation method because, well, you might as well just call a spade a spade.
So, to recap, if we are to believe the thesis that Republicans think that the more people who vote, the less likely they are to win, then it is clear that they are implementing systemic voter suppression tactics to further increase their chances. Things like making it harder to vote in areas that are more democratic, the Comcast method, eliminating people's right to vote by forcing them to pay fines that don't exist, the Marriott method, removing potential voters from the system, the Bloom House method, and then encouraging people not to vote by spreading lies and rumors,
the disinformation method.
To go back to what Chief Justice Roberts said, it's funny how for 50 years, blatantly discriminatory evasions are rare, and as soon as the protections are removed, a bunch of states are like, oh good, we can do it how we want to again. But Claire, all this info is great and all, but I'm registered to vote. I'm doing my civic duty. Why should I take time to understand voter suppression? Well, because it's woven into the American governing experience. And the only way to untangle ourselves from it is to identify it at its root. Additionally, just voting alone isn't quite enough to create equality and justice in this country. But as a reminder, voting is important. It's why we made our very first episode of this podcast about it. As one last example, look back to the last election, where America saw historically its lowest voter turnout ever, and Trump was able to win the election despite having 3 million less votes cast for him than Hillary. Florida was won by less than a percentage point. That is less than 100,000 votes. So please, if you fall into a potentially suppressed demographic, don't let your voice and your right as an American be silenced. Go vote. This all leads back to critical thinking, the buzzword of this podcast. If we continue to ask, why are things this way, we might uncover the how to change them. Up next, we have our returning guest, co-founder of Vote Simple, Delilah Aga-Utahili. All right, for today's interview, we are welcoming back our guest from a few weeks ago. We're going to be talking about voter suppression, as you all heard in the episode before. So welcome back to the show, Delilah Aga-Utahili. Thank you again for coming back.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Claire. It's an important topic.
Yes, yeah. I'm super interested to hear about your platform and your thoughts about voter suppression. So for our friends who maybe missed our episode on voting by mail, could you give a little recap about your background, a little bit of who you are?
Yeah, for sure. So right now I'm currently the National Field Director for Wind Justice, a collaboration between SEIU, Planned Parenthood, Color of Change, and Community Change. And I am the co-founder of a voter registration organization in Texas called Vote Simple. Native Houstonian who has really, you know, worked a number of campaigns across the country the last several years. So prior to joining One Justice, was Beto's State Director for his presidential here in Texas, and in 2018 was the field director for Stacey Abrams in Georgia.
Wow. What was it like working with Beto in Texas during his presidential? Like, I just imagine that was something very memorable.
Yeah, Beto's great, and he is very well loved in Texas, and there are lots of volunteers and activists and folks who are really excited about the work that he did here in 2018 when he was running for Senate, of course, and then again with his presidential, and even honestly that he's doing now, not as a candidate. He started an organization called Powered by People that's really activating volunteers across the country, majority of them in Texas, but honestly, volunteers across the country who are providing capacity, you know, for outreach efforts via calls or texts or online to, again, keep folks engaged for this election to make sure that they go vote. So he's doing great stuff, especially in Texas. I think a state, you know, that a lot of national folks have written off. But I think that Beto sees the potential the same way that I see the potential. Because if we look at the numbers are there. And maybe it's, you know, it's just a matter of investment and making sure people do the work.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I mean, when you think about Texas and they're like, oh, yeah, like so many states can fit in Texas. Like, I'm not sure the number off the top of my head. But think about all those people, and those people are voters, too. So for this episode, we're talking about voter suppression, which is, you know, a whole thing on its own. So what is voter suppression in your definition?
Yeah, good question. I think it's a loaded question.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would say that it's you know, probably an intentional way of creating barriers to voting, right?
Yeah.
And involves efforts that make voting harder and less successful and ultimately, like, disenfranchises, honestly, certain communities. So that is how I would define voter suppression.
Yeah. And And it comes in lots of different forms. So what are some of the ways that voter suppression happens, or and what are some ways that people don't realize might be voter suppression as well?
Yeah, for sure. What I think is interesting, Claire, is I think that people think voter suppression is a thing of the past, right? And honestly, if you look into it, one, it's definitely still happening. And two, was not, you know, wasn't that long ago that we had like a poll tax in certain states where people had to pay to vote. Quick story. The first time I registered someone to vote in Texas, working with Battleground Texas, this older guy came into my office and said that he just moved and he had to update his registration. And he was telling me the story of the first time he voted, how he had to pay 50 cents to vote. And he was young, so he did not have 50 cents. But all the older people in the community pulled together their money to make sure that the young people who, like, you know, just turned old enough to vote were able to actually vote. And here I am, you know, 4 years ago thinking, you know, like, I don't think I've talked to anyone who ever had to pay a poll tax. Or like, if I had to think about paying a poll tax today or what that meant in our society, you know, not sure how that would impact our election. So, I mean, to know, right, that there are people alive today who the first few times they voted, they paid a poll tax, or, you know, when they were 18 or 21 and maybe they were a woman, they also didn't have the right to vote. It's just like we have overcome a lot, but like, you know, we still have a long way to go. And it isn't, it just like, it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, it's honestly like our modern day history, and probably not, yeah, whatever. Anyway, moving on. But I think that today, I would imagine that those parts will be I think that today, voter suppression is not as blatant as it was back in the day, but I think that it happens when we have less voter machines in densely populated urban areas compared to rural areas or suburban areas, right? Ultimately, like causing lines and waiting to the point where people actually get out of those lines and have to go vote so they don't end up voting. I think that voter suppression, you know, kind of lies in voter ID laws in places like Texas, where I am, where we have to require folks to get an ID to actually vote in person. I think it happens when we have polling locations that open late or close early because we have poll workers who maybe unintentionally, you know, are unable to get somewhere on time or close and don't allow people waiting in line to vote. I think it happens when we have outdated machines that don't work properly. Maybe they're so old that they have what we call vote slippage, where you are selecting one person's name on the ballot and actually once you cast your ballot, like changes to the next name down on the line. I think it happens when we don't have enough like polling locations, right? So then finding a polling location is a hurdle if maybe you're driving 30 or 45 minutes to go vote. I also think it happens when we have decreased voting hours. So there's a thing here in Houston, actually this year, there will be polling locations that are open for 24 hours, right? To accommodate folks' work schedules, especially frontline workers. But if we think about it, there are places that, especially during early vote, have hours, maybe they're open from 9 to 5, but if I work from 9 to 5, when am I going to vote, right? Or if it's open from 7 to 5, or if it doesn't work with my work schedule, maybe it's only open on Monday through Fridays. And if I'm not at work, I'm like picking up my kids or caring for someone in the family. So the days and hours of polling locations being open is definitely a way that the vote is suppressed. And I also think that there are, you know, counties, cities, states that make you vote in your precinct and maybe not anywhere in the city or anywhere in the county. So maybe I live in this specific precinct, but I work across town or spend most of my time somewhere else across town. So it's not, maybe it's easier for me to vote on my way to work or when I'm leaving work or when I am not in my precinct because that's where I spend most of the time. So I know there are efforts locally here in Texas, right, to switch counties to having countywide vote centers so that people can vote anywhere in the county and thus making it more accessible. But when we don't have things like that, when we tell people they have one location they can vote at between these like restrictive certain hours and days, also a way that voter suppression happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I even just remember being a child and like my parents having to go vote, but it was a whole thing because they had to somewhere to take care of me and like all of things like that. And you maximize that on a much bigger scale and it's completely different. And especially taking it off away from me because, you know, I have lots of things that I'm sure is allow me to vote differently. But in terms of voting in a state like Texas, who's affected most by voter suppression in states like Texas or anywhere really in the country?
I would probably say it looks the same across the country, but I think that people of color are most affected. I think that youth voters are most affected. I think if we look at what happened in Georgia in 2018 or even Florida in 2016, right? Like in Florida, we had higher rates of young voters and voters of color whose mail ballots were thrown out, maybe because, you know, a signature didn't match or anything of that sort. Not really sure why they were thrown out, but if we look at the data of like whose ballots ultimately weren't counted that tried to vote by mail, they all skew to people of color or youth voters. If we look at what happened in Georgia in 2018, there were polling locations that had extended hours from, you know, they were only supposed to be open until 7 p.m., but maybe they were open until 9 or 10 because there were so many issues on election day. And a lot of those issues, you know, came down to the lack of machines or machines not working and causing delays at these sites. Like it shouldn't take someone 12 hours to vote on election day. But again, if we look at where this happened, like this was happening in the metro area of Atlanta, and maybe not an hour out of Atlanta in the suburbs, you know, where people were in and out of their polling location because there were enough machines. But, you know, we go to Atlanta, you know, more urban, a little bit more diverse, and someone has to wait in line half the day to actually vote. I also think that, you know, college students are disproportionately affected by voter suppression. There was a case here in Texas in 2018, Prairie View A&M, where there was no early voting site near the campus in this county outside of Houston. And there were a group of students, the college's NAACP, who ended up suing, and they won the lawsuit to get an early vote site for the second week of early vote. So it wasn't for the entire week of early vote, unfortunately. But it's like, if you think about, you know, a major college campus being in a rural town probably amounts for a large number of, you know, the people who can vote in that county, and not having a place where college students can vote near them is a problem. But I, lastly, I think that all working class folks are also impacted by like the lack of accessibility. So just going back to thinking about how different areas set the days and the times that polls are open, if a lot of folks have to actually fit going to vote and the time that it takes to vote into their schedules, and it doesn't work with their schedules, then they probably won't vote. So that makes
so much sense. So with all of these times and polling places being open, and, you know, they open at this time, they close at this time, who makes those decisions?
Yeah, I think it looks a little different for every state and probably, honestly, every county as well. But here, you know, there are lots of different public officials involved. So we just expanded our early vote period in Texas, and the governor decided that. So across the entire state, we have an extra week of early voting, which is great because it makes it more accessible. But then on the county level, Houston proper is in Harris County. Our county clerk is the one who decided that we will have like a 24-hour polling location that's open for 24 hours. Also decided that we'll have like drive-through polling locations. I think that's happening in San Antonio too, in Bexar County. So where you can drive up, you know, kind of like a thinking of driving through somewhere like a fast food place. So you drive up and be handed a ballot and fill it out in your car and just hand it back to them. So those decisions were all made on the county level from our clerk's office here in Texas. Honestly, Claire, even at the county level, it doesn't look the same because in some counties we have like an elections office and it's not the clerk who administers the election. But I would think that it happens at the county level or at the gubernatorial level for most states.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would also say that the Secretary of State definitely impacts elections too, depending on where you are. There's a lot of people who could do it, but the Secretary of State and a lot of states that have expanded vote by mail, it was decided by their Secretary of State.
So there's so many people involved, and I wonder if that plays a part into why voting can be super confusing. And, you know, like you were mentioning college students, that some college students are coming from different states and maybe there's a confliction there where they're registered to vote in their home state, but they go to college in another. Did you see that when you were working with college students as well?
Oh yeah, that's definitely, yes. I think that also comes up too with if you're ever doing like voter registration on college campuses, right? Because maybe they're like, oh, I'm registered at home. I don't know if I want to register in Texas or in this other city that I don't live in. Because then they have to figure out, you know, how to vote here, or they have to have this conversation about figuring out how to get a ballot to vote in another state or driving across the state to vote in another city. So I think it, for them, it's, you know, they have to figure out from registration to voting, all of those things about where they want to be involved in the electoral process.
Yeah. And in voting as something that is something that we all should be involved in and something that we should all care about, is there anything that people can do about voter suppression? Is there anything that people can learn about or understand that maybe they don't know off the bat about voting?
Yeah, I think it's something that like impacts all of us, just because at the end of the day, right, like it will be more rampant this year than ever before. And I think we have so much at stake this election, and not just like because we're in the middle of a presidential election, but we have so many public officials to vote for in every state down ballot. And if we think about it, right, like we should care about electing the folks who can impact, you know, voter accessibility in the future. Like governors are on ballots, secretary of states are on ballots, county clerks are on ballots. So like everyone who has some hand in administering the election or can have some impact on making voting more safe or easy or accessible in their state is voted into office. So at some point, right, like we should care because we have some control over who that person is and making sure that we elect the people who won't actively suppress votes.
Yeah, that's super important. And that's something that we're trying to do with this podcast too, is tell people to go out and not only advocate for themselves, but advocate for other people as well.
Yeah, I would encourage people to, I think in a lot of states, there are either organizations or political parties that have voter protection hotlines. I would encourage them to find their state's voter protection hotline and write that down and call in if they see anything suspicious. And that's from, you know, anything at a polling location to even anything around, you know, voting methods that happen before election day. So whether there are like drop boxes in their neighborhood or counties that they, you know, if you witness anything, call a voter protection hotline. And there are, you know, usually trained workers who can deal with that and fix those issues. But we can't fix issues if we never know that they're happening.
Yeah.
But I would also encourage people, we even didn't talk about this, Claire, but to become poll workers, because we're in the middle of a pandemic, right? And a lot of people who usually work the polls are older or elderly, retired folks who love voting, right? And don't miss voting or working the polls. They are choosing not to, right? Because it may not be safe for them to work the polls. So there's a shortage of poll workers across the country. So with this shortage, there's a concerted effort in lots of states to recruit high school students or college students to be poll workers, because while we have expanded access to vote by mail, we still need to make sure that these early vote locations and these election day polling locations that we have people who can work them. Because when we think back to accessibility, polling locations will close if we do not have numbers or workers, right? If we do not have the accurate number of workers to work them, then like they can't open a polling location. So actually, I think back to when the pandemic hit, I was working an election in Chicago, and a number of polling locations were closed in Chicago just because there are so many poll workers who said they were unable to work. So if we have this bank of volunteers who are maybe, you know, healthier, less at risk than the demographic of poll workers that we normally have, then we should be able to have more polling locations open and less voter suppression.
Which is always the goal, right?
Yes.
You touched on how a lot of poll workers tend to be older and, you know, they never miss the vote, whereas younger people sometimes aren't as interested. Why do you think that exists?
I mean, honestly, I just feel like there's like this context that older people take into account when they think of voting that like maybe we did not like live through, right?
Yeah.
So kind of back, going back to the first story I told, like, I think that there are people who to this day remember when women got the right to vote, right? Or remember when polling taxes weren't a thing anymore. Or maybe were raised by folks who, you know, told them about the first time that they vote and what that meant for them coming from marginalized communities where, you know, it was okay for us not to have the right to vote. So I think that today though, right, we're just like so far removed from that history that, you know, we don't have that context that I think like drives us to the polls. Yeah. In the same way that I think it drives some older people. I remember when I was doing voter registration for Battleground, there were lots of times I would ask like older Black women if they were registered to vote, and they would look at me like I was crazy. They were like, of course I'm registered, right? Because it's like, in what world would they not be registered to vote? Because, you know, I think of everything it means for everything it means and everything it took for Black people to have the right to vote and for women to have the right to vote, like, of course, they're going to be registered. But I think that, you know, if we look at some younger people, maybe they think their vote doesn't matter. Maybe they think that the candidates on the ballot don't represent their interests, or maybe they're, you know, feeling a little uninspired. And I think it's less about, you know, this fundamental like right to vote and more about feeling a little disconnected from everything else involved.
Yeah. It's not so much about, yeah, like what you said, the right to vote, but what you're actually voting for. And that's sort of a disconnect between it. Delilah, this has been super wonderful and super informative. I have one last question for you. It might be a little bit of a doozy, but in your perfect future world, what does voting look like for you?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, actually, because I think we see now, right? I think voting rights is the issue of voting rights has been elevated post 2018 more than it was any time recently, right? And I think we see this debate happening where folks are discussing whether or not we should like make voting mandatory or whether we should have like a national holiday for voting. And I don't believe in like the government making lots of things compulsory for us. But I do think, right, in a perfect world, we would work towards having a election day be a national holiday, which would, again, alleviate some of these issues around voter suppression and accessibility. I also then think, right, like if people choose to vote, then they will be able to vote and should not have work obligations or school obligations or anything else that keeps them from voting. But I also think that, you know, in a perfect world, I would want to live in a county that had voting centers where I could vote wherever I wanted, right? That did not have a voter ID law, because you can confirm someone as a voter without them showing you a photo ID once they go to vote. I also, you know, would want to see expanded access to vote by mail so that anyone who wanted to vote by mail could vote by mail every election if they chose to. And honestly, just expanded access to early voting as well. And early voting that spans, you know, entire weeks before the election, because some places only do it like Monday through Friday. But we need to increase weekend hours and accessibility as well. So yeah, that is, I think that in a perfect world, I think that would remove a lot of barriers that I can think of right now.
That sounds amazing. And I have faith that someday we can get there.
I don't know if, I feel like, Claire, I should say that in a perfect world, we could vote online, but like that also just like sends my head spinning.
Yeah.
What that looks like.
Yeah, the internet is a crazy place. And I've been reading some articles about, you know, how things in other countries work and, you know, things like that where, yeah, keep me up at night for sure. Well, Delilah, thank you so much. This has been super wonderful. I've loved interviewing you. If any of our listeners want to know about more of the work you're doing, where can they find that?
Yeah, I would encourage everyone to check out Vote Simple. Our website is www.votesimple.org. You can sign up to partner with us or donate or learn more. Or register to vote, honestly, and also check your voter registration before any deadline.
Great, thank you so much. Today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.